Welcome to the GoTo Podcast. Each episode covers the brightest and boldest ideas from the world's leading experts in software development. Tune in for practical lessons, compelling theories, and plenty of inspiration. GoTo gathers the brightest minds in the software community to help developers tackle projects today, plan for tomorrow, and create a better future. Stay up to date with the latest in tech through GoTo's top-rated events held online and in person in cities like Amsterdam, London, Copenhagen, and Chicago, and by subscribing to the GoTo Conferences YouTube channel, where you can find thousands more high-quality dev talks. Learn more at gotopia.tech.
Hello and welcome to this episode of the GoTo Podcast. I'm Charles Humble. I'm a freelance techie editor, author, and consultant. And this is the second in a mini series of podcasts that I'm going to be doing talking to engineering leaders. I'm aiming for each episode to have actionable insights and suggestions for further research, such as books and papers to read, conference talks to watch, and so on. For this episode, we're joined by Owen Woods. Owen has worked in the field of software engineering in one capacity or another for about 30 years, and he's currently chief engineer at Endava, the established and fast-growing software engineering and technology transformation company. Prior to taking up his current role, Owen served as their CTO for client delivery for about 8.5 years. He is a regular conference speaker and the author or co-author of a number of books on software architecture, including Software Architecture Metrics for O'Reilly and Continuous Architecture in Practice, which he co-authored with Murat Erda and Pierre Pura, and which is published as part of the Alison Wesley Signature Series. Owen, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Charles. Good to be here. Thank you for the invitation.
Pleasure. So I mentioned a couple of your architecture books there. So I thought maybe an interesting place to start would be to talk about the context of software architecture and how that's changed over time. Because I think you and I got our start at about the same time, plus or minus a few years. And certainly when I started in software, I think it was maybe necessary to make more decisions up front than it is now. At least that was how it was done. So can you maybe talk about how the role of architecture has kind of changed and evolved over time?
Yes, definitely. Yeah, great question. And yeah, I think you hit the nail on the head was that I always tell engineers now that they think I'm very, very old because I say when I started building systems, we started with Unix and a C compiler and there wasn't a lot else. And you perhaps had a database system, but sometimes you actually had a library which gave you access to indexed files. I mean, it was a lot more primitive. And even coming forwards from that into I suppose what mainstream application software was as the internet boom was going on, there was a lot of stuff you had to build yourself, and there were a lot of decisions that were quite hard to change later, and there was no such thing as cloud that let you reconfigure your infrastructure on the fly. So all of that meant that software architecture was inherently a fairly upfront design business. And of course, this is where in the early days of Agile and a real philosophical collision with Agile that was trying to defer decisions as long as possible. And lots of people like me had been schooled in manage your risk early, do early prototypes, get your critical decisions made, make sure you know what the structure of the system is before you start investing a lot in the software development. And then of course, everything changed. Languages became more flexible. We standardized on pretty well Linux as the platform for the industry. Cloud happened, so it was a huge amount of infrastructure was just available and you could reconfigure it on demand, and open source came along. And so suddenly, rather than having to build a lot from scratch, we were much more assembling pieces or building inside quite sophisticated frameworks. You look at things like the Spring ecosystem, or for the Python people, the Django ecosystem. There's an awful lot there to start with, and so quite a lot of architecture exists already. But in return, people don't expect to have to make all their architecture decisions up front. They really do expect to be able to evolve things much more as they go. And so that's where the role of the architect has changed. And I think some architects have made that transition very naturally, and some of them find it a little bit unsettling, really. They do like to get things decided up front, as they would put it. And while understanding the instinct, today, really people expect to be able to evolve their systems much, much more quickly and much more continuously because the old constraints have gone away. So why shouldn't they be able to modify them, change their mind as they go, if you like? Or it really, it's all about responding to an evolving business landscape, which your competitors are doing, so you'd probably better be able to do it too. So architecture is now less about the big blueprint up front and more about making good decisions right through the life cycle of the system.
Yes, it's interesting that, isn't it? I think it's probably fair to say that architecture kind of lagged a bit behind what was happening with Agile and software delivery in general, at least to begin with. And I guess some of that is, you say it was a big shift in terms of what we were used to doing. Do you think that change applies to all the sort of different types of architecture equally? I mean, obviously it aligns well with application architecture, but does it align equally well with maybe enterprise architecture or infrastructure architecture in the same way?
I think it has affected different specializations differently. My background is very much software architecture, application architecture, and that is the one that's, I think, been most dramatically affected. I think infrastructure architecture has been affected pretty dramatically too. Now it's much more, in fact, many of the skills they're now using as infrastructure architects are closer to software developers than originally when they were actually, you know, hardware engineers who knew a huge amount about physical devices. So I think that world has moved a lot. Enterprise architecture, actually, I think it's really, for many enterprise architects, they're stuck in a difficult situation. On the one hand, they're expected, you know, the enterprise expects a five-year plan. On the other hand, the technology organization expects them to be able to change every 5 weeks. And that's a very uncomfortable position to be in, where for some things they're trying to reflect upwards or across the organization, there is stability, there is a plan, we know what we're doing, there is a strategy. And on the other hand, trying to make the application teams feel empowered and the fact this is a modern and dynamic place to work. So I think EA is probably the point where the road is dividing a bit and skilled EAs are having to kind of bridge both parts of that and talk a slightly different language and work out how you, within perhaps an overriding well-understood structure, you provide people with the ability to evolve continuously.
Yeah, actually, I think that's really interesting because I know from some of the consulting work that I've done that, you know, enterprises might have fixed budgets and those kind of things, and they want that degree of, you know, we're going to spend X million on this project or this work stream or whatever it is. And it can be very difficult, I think, to fit that into the sort of continuous delivery models that we're, you know, that generally we want to be working in as IT people.
Yes, well, there's an awful lot of organizations talk about wanting to be dynamic and agile and yet have a 12-month budgeting cycle and a five-year strategy. And you sort of feel those two things don't really fit together. And so they're sort of asking for the impossible, really. And that's where I think often EA end up in a very awkward kind of rather high-friction boundary between the two.
Yes, yeah. Do you think, are there other trade-offs in terms of a sort of the continuous architecture approach, do you think? Are there things like technical debt that might be higher, or are there other trade-offs, do you think?
I think there can be. I think it depends on your context. I think we used to kid ourselves that the big design up front actually avoided technical debt and we were always in control and, we, you know, there was always a plan. Actually, things did change. We just had to sort of force them in, and often perhaps we weren't entirely honest with ourselves as to how effective the architecture was being there, why there was a lot of architectural drift. But definitely, if you're going to make decisions as late as you can and you're going to evolve all the time, you are going to make, or you're going to end up in a situation where you need to change things. You can't always change things at the time because either there's a regulatory deadline or there's competitive pressure or you're running out of money or whatever it is. And that inevitably is going to create technical debt. Is it more than it used to be? I'm not sure. Intuitively, I'm not sure it is really, but it's definitely something which in continuous architecture, actually, we're always saying, manage it much more intentionally, perhaps, than you used to. Whether or not it's higher or lower, you're going to have it. Continuous architecture almost implies a degree of accepting technical debt as you're moving. So if you don't manage that intentionally, we all know what will happen. It will eventually kill you. Because your velocity will go to zero and you just won't be able to make progress anymore.
Yes, right. Something I wanted to talk about is the process you go through as an architect. And maybe you can talk about this a bit in the context of your experience at Endava. And particularly I'm thinking about how you go about things like gathering requirements, which was an endless source of frustration and challenge for me. You know, you go and ask a question and get an answer, and then you'd seek clarification, and the stakeholder would go, no, that's not what I meant at all. How do you sort of manage that process? What would your advice be in terms of getting requirements and understanding what the business needs?
The key insight I had some years ago was you only validator requirement when it's running in production. You can ask stakeholders repeatedly, you can run surveys, you can do workshops. We have a whole professional discipline analysis who are experts at all of that. And I think all of them would also say, yes, but actually we don't know till it's running in production. It's just our best guess until we've actually got it with real users using it. So I think for me, the key journey I've been on is going from, you know, when I started off, I came out of a deep love really of formal methods, very much getting things perfect to begin with. That was very much how I thought software engineering should be. I've been on quite a journey now to actually, it's more important to get something imperfect, but probably reliable, but imperfect into operation and be able to change it than it is to try to build exactly the right thing perfectly before you put it into operation. So actually, I think that's the key to knowing what your requirements are. It's getting a good enough, credible set to start with, not building too much, but getting it used. And getting it used, especially in a big enterprise, there's often that contrary can be difficult. You say, I haven't really got your risk management system, but I do have some screens that allow you to view this data. People go, why would I bother? I wanted a risk management system. But so culturally, that's a bit of a discussion. It's a bit of movement on both sides. But even in big companies, it's trying to get people just to look at stuff and go, no, that's not what I meant. Great, because we've only done 5% of the development work, and now I understand what you actually wanted. Of course, the problem with that approach is there are, from the architect's perspective, there are architectural things. You have to make quite big decisions. And some of those, although we try and make it as flexible as possible, they are quite hard to reverse later. So, and that, I think, is where domain knowledge and technical judgment come in, is that if you can get inside the domain, and often, of course, it's difficult for a consultant. I know you've been a consultant for many years crossing domains, but this is where domain knowledge really helps, I think, because you can just credibly think in your head, it's going to be stream processing, or I think we'll have to use events here, or we can't use events here. We're going to have to make this, whatever it is, client server. There's a blast from the past. you just intuitively know quite a lot about the data models and the way the system will be used to make some of the big calls quite early. Not that they couldn't be reversed, but it's going to be a lot of effort. So it's better to get the guess in roughly the right place.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting, actually. I think it's a really interesting trade-off with consulting, because sometimes you have a sort of clarity, and obviously you see lots of different organizations, so you get a sense of what does and doesn't work in different places. But at the same time, you don't have the sort of deep domain knowledge that perhaps an in-house architect that's been there 5 years or 10 years or whatever would have.
Yeah, that's actually, Dava's an interesting thing. I think we've seen great results, actually, from encouraging some of our delivery workforce to specialize in certain industries. And it's not for everyone. Some people just don't want to do that. They want to be technical experts. And that's absolutely fine too. We have people who are sort of domain generic, but technically specialist. But we also have people who've decided to, for example, stay for long periods in the insurance industry or the payments industry. And we think that, especially early on in projects, those people are really valuable just because they have that intuition. When the client says, claims order process is going to work like this, they can think to themselves, that's strange because no one else does it that way. Have I misunderstood something? Rather than, yeah, that sounds fine, and just go ahead and misunderstand it.
Yes, absolutely. Can you talk about the necessary sort of, I hate to use the word soft skills, I'm trying to avoid it, people skills for architecture. What would you say are kind of like the essential skills that you need as an architect, not from a technical standpoint, but beyond the sort of technical?
I think key ones are all around communication, and there's a number of different aspects to that. You do need to be able to listen. I do know, myself probably included, there are quite a few architects who are never happier than when front of a whiteboard with their pen talking, or using Miro today perhaps, but talking. Not all architects are brilliant listeners, and of course, unless you do listen, you're likely to end up building the wrong thing or building it wrongly or disappointing someone. So I think, and listening is a skill. It's one that, for example, I'm not sure universities teach you to listen particularly well. It's just, it's not seen as a first-class skill, but actually listening is important. Regional is empathy. Understanding, for example, it's being able to understand why somebody appears to be doing something illogical or inefficiently or strangely, just rather than being rather superior about it and going, well, you know, we'll just improve all this, it's thinking, hang on, they've been doing this for 7 years. There might be a good reason. And just trying to understand them. And then I think being able to present complicated ideas as simply as they can be, but not more so to, you know, use the famous quote. I think the key supporting skill there is abstraction. It's not overwhelming your audience, whoever they are, actually technical or non-technical people, with all of the detail that's in your head. It's being able to pull out the salient points for that conversation and relate the concepts very, very clearly so that people understand what you're saying, why, what the implications are, and then being able to go into a different conversation and perhaps having a completely different set of points or level of detail. So that's what Gregor Hoppe talks about, his architect elevator. You know, you can talk to people in a boardroom, it's very abstract, and you can talk to people who are writing code. Well, that's considerably less abstract. But you actually have to be able to work in those different contexts.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting. I think the point about listening actually is really key. And I have to say that where I've got that wrong, and I have got it wrong, you know, I like to think I've learned a bit over the years, but certainly on my first one or two projects as an architect, I was maybe a bit overconfident and, you know, would go in and do something and then just, as you say, it's sort of like, why are you doing it? You know, surely we can shortcut all of that. And it's very, very tempting to think that you've understood something better than you have, maybe.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. And not really listening to the voices of experience that are in the room, often because they're quite quiet and they perhaps don't particularly want to make a big fuss about it, but they do actually know why something is done twice or why we created this strange user interface that is navigated with a tab key and the arrow keys as opposed to the mouse. Well, actually, the reason for that is it had to be used in this context, and it still does.
Yeah, I did a project for a retail bank call center in the UK many, many years ago, and it was mainframes, and the call center were literally using kind of green screens. And diving off to the two or three different mainframes that ran it was a bank that had merged with other banks. So you had some two or three separate systems and call centers with like two or three green screens, and they were jumping around. And we were kind of, you know, modernizing the whole thing and doing a new UI with a, you know, a browser based UI. And we did these beautiful, beautiful screens. And we were terribly proud of them. And we put them in front of the call center staff and they hated them. Absolutely hated them. And the reason was that they suddenly had to click around. So after you pass ID&B and got in, it's like, but here I've got all the information you want. And yes, it has a learning curve like a brick, but once I've learned it, everything I want is in one place. Well, as with your thing, I can go over here and over here. And so, so we ended up, you know, like with these desperate cryptic abbreviations and fonts you needed to read with a magnifying glass, but they were happy.
That's right. Yeah. I had a similar thing with an Endava cloud some years ago where they had a desktop product, which was, I can't remember, in Turbo Pascal or something really, really old, but still in use. I mean, used lots of professional practices up and down, at least in Britain, maybe internationally, and being replaced by a SaaS-based browser system. And just the same thing, lots and lots of people in these professional practices had learned all the keystrokes and the sequences of keystrokes. They do stuff really fast, and they had to go and reproduce them in a modern web UI. It was kind of hilarious exercise, really.
Yes,
human backwards compatibility rather than technical backwards compatibility.
Right. Yes. Yes. I said in my intro that you worked as delivery CTA for quite a while at Endava. So, was part of that role around sort of setting the technical culture within the organization? Was that kind of a chunk of what you were doing?
Yes, I'm still very involved in that. Yes. So, my main day-to-day job now, I'm now referred to as the chief engineer, which is, it's been more of a title change than a role change.
Right.
Is that because a CTO, it confused everybody because I had nothing to do with internal IT. So I had dozens of inbound sales calls from people wanting to sell me stuff or recycle my laptops. It was a constant thing. Waste of their time and a waste of mine. Obviously most CTOs are very much sort of executive managers. People who know me will know I'm not really the executive manager type. I'm much more the, you know, principal engineer type. So, yes, we changed the role title to make it clear that actually I'm focused on how we do engineering. And as chief engineer, my the main core of my role is how do we go about delivering cloud projects really well? So have we got the right skills in the right places? What should we be investing in? How should we be developing people's skills? And then how do we actually run a project? What do we know? What do we don't know? Where are the gaps? What have we done before that has been successful? And we have a fantastic delivery framework called TEAM, stands for the Endava Adaptive Method. And that really encapsulates what we've learned in 20 years of delivery. And it's got a scaled agile model inside it, engineering practices, and also a model actually we call engagement, which is how you deal with the client in a structured way that, you know, everything's very transparent and the client doesn't get surprises and we don't get surprises. So I'm responsible for that model and I'm lucky to have a terrific team work on it. But the key thing is that we don't write it. It's actually the practitioners in the job families who are doing the job every day actually write the content. We're custodians and we're cheerleaders and we're editors and we coordinate and we run communities. We try and get the whole thing moving, but actually the input comes from the people who are working on the project. And I think that's what's so important, is that we're reusing real knowledge. We're not asserting that in an ideal world something might be nice. This has worked before, or this doesn't work. That's another very common reason for changes in the framework, which is we thought this worked and it has worked, but generally a lot of projects it does not work very well. I'll let you know, take that out or add some extra columns to the spreadsheet, or give pointers to a wider range of resources, because actually the ones we had we didn't realize were actually quite narrow, and a load of people have arrived and said this doesn't work for us, and so rework it. For example, testing, big field, but with lots of advice on testing. And many times we've taken good advice from one project, found it was actually quite a narrow domain, and then had to go back and generalize because lots of other projects that arrived and went, no, this doesn't work at all. So it's very much an iterative process of learning by doing.
I think that's really interesting. I think quite often, as an industry, I think we're quite prone to sort of cargo culting, or we'll take that model from over here and we'll stick it in over there, and sometimes it works quite well and sometimes it doesn't at all, because you don't have the the Spotify model is probably the sort of canonical example of this, we'll replicate the Spotify model. I'm not sure the Spotify model really ever worked with Spotify. it was quite theoretical when they were talking about it. I think, they've ended up with something that looks a bit like that and a bit like that. But you know what I mean? It's sort of like, well, just pick it up and drop it in and, it doesn't work that way.
Organization. Oh, that's surprising.
Isn't that startling? Yes.
We're a high street bank. For some reason, our model that was successful in internet streaming music hasn't applied to our business.
Who'd have thought? That's it. I find that fascinating, actually.
When I took the job, there were two things that I realized very early I didn't want to do, because I'd seen elsewhere. One was to have some sort of methods group, a group of people who know a lot in principle or theoretically about software development. They've read all the books. But I didn't want a group of those people writing a sort of delivery method. And a lot of this predated me, but it was very much, that was my philosophy when I arrived. The other thing was not to have a quality department. That's people with clipboards who don't do the work going around telling people how they should do the work. And so TEAM predates me by many years. I've just been lucky enough to run the team. It's made it even better. But we've continually reinforced this principle by practitioners for practitioners. And then rather than a quality department, we have what we call cross-project review. And that's where one project, the technical seniors from one project, pop up on another project and say, can we help? Can we see what you do? And then they sort of explain what they do and they go, oh, that's very interesting. And how about this? And is that the best you could do there? Well, no, actually, now you mention it, we probably should improve that. And so that there's a kind of, it's a whole discussion happens on a very part-time basis for a number of weeks. And then the review team, writes up a standard sort of template of tables of stuff for improvement and hands it over. And the really fascinating thing is that when I first introduced this, I was a bit nervous as to how people would enjoy it or not. Actually, both teams love it. The team being assessed are normally quite proud of their project. I mean, and even if not, it can be quite cathartic to, share the fact that it's not working very well. And the team doing the review find it really interesting, not just because they get to see another project, because they're seeing really good stuff to take back to their projects. I never really realised that it would work in both directions, but it does. And so, project A will look at project B, project B will go off and look at project C will go and look at project A. That's the idea. So rather than some department telling everyone what to do, again, you get projects just looking at each other saying, if we were you, we'd probably improve it. Or I can see why you're doing that. I think that's probably better than what we're doing in our project. But yes, well done. That's really good. So it's more like having, you know, having your professional friends turn up and give you some constructive coaching.
I really like that. I hadn't heard that before. I mean, I think that's brilliant, actually. Presumably, are there cultural aspects to that? I mean, I guess you need quite high psychological safety and that sort of thing.
Definitely. We're a very open kind of organization. We're quite direct with each other, but we're also kind, I think, in most cases. We're thoughtful. I mean, thoughtful is one of our values, as in think about the other person when you're talking to them. So yes, the openness is important, but the thoughtfulness is important too, is that I think just our culture is one of not annoying people, trying to score points, trying to help people to be the best that we can be is our catchphrase for it. It's that's what our culture is really centered around. It's about make sure the client's successful, you know, treat them like a person, you know, make them successful because that's what they're paying for, and help yourself and everyone else to be the best you can be inside our company. So that sort of environment's quite good actually for peer-to-peer kind of reviews, because you don't tend to get people turning up trying to score points or, you know, make some point that they're in some way superior. There's no benefit in doing that.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, I'm still a big fan of code reviews, which I think are sort of fairly unfashionable now, but I learned so much from having, you know, when I started out, from having someone who knew more than me coming in and looking at my code and going, why have you done that? Or have you thought about, you know, I learned a bunch that way. But again, it's got to feel safe. Otherwise, it's just, you just feel like your work's being ripped apart. And that's
different. You feel very defensive. Yeah. And some people are great code reviewers and some are a bit brutal and often undoes actually the very useful input that they had, because it's just rejected because it's presented in a particular way. Which is a shame.
Yes, yeah. And I've had it, you know, I mean, I've worked as an editor at InfoQ and places for years as well, and I've had it there too, where, you know, some people really like feedback on their articles, but you've got to do it in the right way. Otherwise, it just, you know, you get people's defenses up and
of course,
you know, and then they're less receptive to the feedback you're trying to get to them. I'm curious as to how you keep that culture going as you scale the organization, because your endeavor's grown quite fast, isn't it?
It has. It was about 1,700 people when I joined, and it's now something like 11,500 or 12,000. So, yes, right. It's a lot bigger. Yes. We were just in three or four countries when I joined, and now it's, I lose track, but I think it's 14, 15, 16, something like that. I think the culture is partly carried by people. When we start in new countries, we find great culture carriers from our existing countries and invite them to spend a year or 2 years in the new country building the culture. I think the culture, one of the things the culture is very explicit and we talk about it quite a lot. It's one of the things that always reassures me. I've had people quite senior levels come into the organization, and after a number of months, they'll almost in a puzzled way say, people here actually think the values are important, don't they? And you go, well, yes, that's why we put them on the wall. They went, yeah, I mean, a lot of places put them on the wall. That doesn't necessarily mean that anyone thinks they're important. And it comes from the top. I mean, our CEO, John Cottrell, is an exceptional person. He's, of course, he's a manager because he has a tremendous amount of direct power, but he's also a great leader. I mean, the two things, you know, John can inspire people to do the right thing and also has the ability to tell people what to do. But he is very good at living the culture himself and being very demonstrative in how he's applying it. And I think that just kind of comes down then through the senior people, is that even when we're doing mergers and acquisitions, as soon as people meet John, they realise he is behaving in a certain way, which is perhaps unusual for a CEO. And then people realise that this is actually the way that the company operates.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think it's impressive. You know, a lot of companies struggle when they get beyond a certain size to keep the sort of culture alive and going. Presumably you hire to your values and that sort of thing as well. Do you?
Yeah, so that's part of the hiring checklist is asking some probing questions about how you view different kinds of situations, asking people what our kind of values mean to them, making sure that people will feel comfortable in them. I mean, we're not for everyone. I'm quite sure of that. And I'm sure lots of people would find this very annoying place to work for whatever reason. Luckily, you know, many people like working here, which is great. But I'm sure there are people who wouldn't fit. But the culture and value alignment is an explicit part of the hiring process. Absolutely.
And you've been there quite a long time as well, which isn't, you know, I mean, generally, we tend to move around quite a lot.
Oh, it's the longest I've ever been. Yes. I mean, before Endava, I think the longest I've been anywhere was 5 years. Yeah, I've been here nine and a bit now.
What do you do to encourage innovation in Endava?
So we've got various ideas on innovation. We try and, I think on one hand, completely grassroots and informally, we just try and make people think about what they're doing intentionally. I've often said my catchphrase around innovation is it's applying the right tool and technique to the right job and thinking about it every time and not just doing it the way we used to do it. And sometimes that's applying quite pedestrian technology, but in a completely new way. And that is, in my view, just as innovative as taking something bleeding edge and applying it for the first time. The way that we do it a bit more systematically is that we have an innovation community. Simona Tanislav is our group innovation manager, and she has fostered, built a community of people interested in innovation. It's a big distributed one right across the firm. So you get little local innovation communities, and they all come together for global events, which are all virtual, as you can imagine. And then the big event we have once a year is Endava Innovation Labs, and it's a competition where it happens at local level, so inside locations and countries. Then the winners of that go through to regional finals. The people from the regional finals go through to about, it's 10 teams now, go through to a grand final. That's the global final. And for that, we actually fly people, you know, into a centre. All 10 teams present. There's a group of pretty senior people we bring into judging. I'm there many years. John Cottrell, our CEO, comes. David Churchill, head of people, Matt Cloak, our CTO, will try and be there. So, you know, it's quite a big event. We make quite a big fuss. We do lots of video at the event and, you know, make videos afterwards. And frankly, we just get remarkable entries. This year was the year of AI. You will not be surprised to hear. But even there, people were applying it in really clever and really thoughtful ways to lots of different problems, from information processing to medical to transport and others. It was great to see. And I think what happens is that we keep saying at the grassroots, think about what you're doing. Don't do it the same way as last time if you can improve it. We then have a community which is pretty friendly and quite informal and relaxed. And then we have the competition, which gets a lot of attention. And so that reinforces the loop back to people thinking, yeah, That big all the stuff went on in the innovation labs. Well, actually, at my level, I could be rethinking about, are we using Azure DevOps properly? Because that's also innovation. And so those are really the three levels that we use to keep innovation running inside the company, inside cloud delivery.
That's really interesting. Is that your sort of innovation community? That's different, I'm guessing, from like an innovation center type approach. I'm just curious to get your sort of take on.
Yeah, it totally is. It's all self-selecting people. It's a combination of company time and their own time, but there's quite a bit of their own time involved. And it's very self-directed. So it's a group of people in one of our locations who want to talk about innovation, want to practice innovation, want to learn more about innovation. And then the global community is those local communities deciding to be part of the global community and attend events or present to others or show off projects that they've done. So the idea is to get it permeating the organization rather than have a group off here somewhere called the Innovation Center who apparently do all the innovation. I've seen that in corporate land quite a lot, and I've tended to find that there are some good examples, but in many cases, it doesn't transfer into the organization very well, because often these people are freed from all of the constraints that everyone else is under, because they're sent off to a WeWork and they all get Macs when the corporate standard is Windows, and they don't have to take corporate security into account, and they don't have to go through reviews, and they can use loads of crazy technology that some corporate standard bans, and they create lots of lovely stuff. And then everyone goes, okay, could we just put that in production? And everyone goes, oh no, well, it doesn't run on Windows. And we've used all this crazy stuff, and it's not very secure. And And you're thinking, what was the point of that, honestly? I mean, it's kind of made everyone feel better for 20 minutes, but it's not going to transfer. Whereas what we're trying to do is to just get the thinking behind innovation permeating the organization. We also have a budget, our internal projects group, very slippy name, which I run, which, you know, we try and support. If people need small amounts of money or time, we try and sponsor things, because we're just trying to get it across the organization rather than centered in one place.
Are there things that individual managers can do or do to encourage sort of innovation within a team?
I think on a client delivery project, at least at Endava, the thing that the delivery manager, that's the person accountable for the whole project, they can constantly be doing is challenging the team. Is that the best way we could have done it? What are the problems with that? Is that different to the last time we did it? And is it better? It's simple questions like that. Just keep the sort of continuous improvement mindset, which I think actually leads to real innovation, just keeps it alive and keeps challenging people. And that sort of has to run down the project. I mean, the tech leads, we call the technical leadership scrum, which is all of the tech leads on a project. They need to be challenging themselves, as they're not, you know, going and asking the teams, what have we improved? This scrum, this sprint, this month, this quarter, whatever it is.
That's brilliant. I think that's a really good place to round it up, actually. And thank you very much indeed. That's been fascinating. Really appreciate your time.
Thank you, Charles.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the GoTo Podcast. Head over to gotopia.tech to discover lots more content from the brightest minds in software development.